I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/Inner Academy.
Everyone, this is Chris Grosso with the Indie Spirituals podcast on the Be Here Now network, and my guest today is Dr. Miles Neal. Miles, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Chris. I'm looking forward to having some time with you.
You and I, this has been a long time in the making, so I'm really psyched to jump into this with you. But first things first, just want to share your bio with our audience for anyone who's not familiar with your work. Dr. Miles Neal is among the leading voices of the current generation of Buddhist teachers and a forerunner in the emerging field of contemplative psychotherapy. He is a Buddhist psychotherapist in private practice, assistant director of the Nalanda Institute for Contemplative Science, and faculty lecturer at Tibet House US and Weill Cornell Medical College. Dr. Neal's approach to personal healing and transformation is informed by contemplative neuroscience and integration of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist mind science, depth psychotherapy, and current neuroscience. His free podcasts and YouTube videos have reached thousands, expressing ancient Buddhist principles and practices in a modern, accessible, and impassioned way. Dr. Neal's new book, Gradual Awakening, The Tibetan Buddhist Path of Becoming Fully Human, critiques modern materialism and explores the Tibetan Buddhist gradual path to awakening based on the art and neuroscience of visualization. And with that said, again, Miles, welcome to the show, and I'm very excited to talk to you about this book today.
Awesome. Let's jump in.
I love it. So, first things first, I mean, we can go a number of different ways with this conversation. We're going to jump into the book, but for anyone not familiar with you, I like to give my guests a little time to introduce yourself as far as what led you to your line of work, to the Buddhist path, to contemplative neuroscience, things of that nature. And you can start as far back as you want. I hand it over to you.
Well, doesn't it always start with tremendous suffering?
Fair enough.
I mean, for me, it's no different. I think most people that find their way into the spiritual world come by way through the threshold of some unfortunate circumstance, and I'm no different in that regard. Sure. As far as I've been sentient, conscious in knowing that something was amiss or awry, I can remember that happening at least 15, 16 years old. You know, I grew up the son of a British textile trader and a Levantine interior designer. I was born in Singapore and raised in Hong Kong, and already had a very multicultural, multi-heritage, and a lot of privilege and fortune, and living overseas and attending good schools and having a lot of opportunities. But something was sort of, there was a thorn in the mind, let's put it that way, at a very early age. And, you know, there was alcoholism in my family, and there was a lot of conflict and chaos and tumult, and really no spiritual inclination, and also no emotional kind of balance or maturity. And I was struggling early, and I was fortunate to find a couple of teachers in high school whom had had the privilege to be raised in India and were teaching religious studies, Buddhism, and I even had one faculty member at the high school who had been exposed to Stan Grof, who was one of the forerunners in the consciousness studies movement. And so between the three of these teachers, I got some exposure to Buddhism and some psychology, and really, I don't know if I would have made it without them. They became more than just teachers. They became emotional supports and friends. And so my path really starts early on in Asia, lost and in a lot of pain and very confused and without a perspective to assist me, really. I mean, you know, the thing is, well, one thread that will carry through all the way through the current book is that modern materialistic culture was failed me,
like, yeah.
Because I definitely had achieved the successes, one would say, that are billed as the, you know, the sort of orientation for anybody in a modern materialistic world: to have family and to have a good job and to have money and to have opportunity. But then, you know, there isn't really anything said about what's happening on the inside of one's mind and what's happening on the inside between family members. And so that paid the ultimate price for me. And if it weren't for finding mentors very early on in my story whom could provide some structure and understanding and meaning and purpose for the internal world, I may not be here. You know, there's no guarantee that I would have made it, literally. So I guess that's where the story starts, you know, and it continues on in that vein. I can say that I have been a seeker most of my life. I have been dissatisfied with the paradigm of materialistic culture and what it purports to be, you know, the sort of agenda of what a life is meant to be oriented towards. And I found my way to college and instantaneously found these archetype, you know, these archetypes have been around me since I was 16, the archetype of an elder who is a wisdom lineage holder who provides access to a doorway through which an entire new culture, paradigm, wisdom, tradition bestows some meaning and a new alternative orientation for my life. So by the time I'm 18 and I'm at college, I meet a zany Zen psychoanalyst who had used, you know, taken over the blackboard on our first day of class, and across the blackboard had written, you know, all suffering comes from I, me, and mine. And so I was like, what the fuck is that? I mean, I ended up having a very deep friendship with him that went well beyond the classroom. We were, you know, we would share stories together at his house in Duxbury, Massachusetts, and he would invite me to his Zen garden. And eventually he took me to the Zen Center in Providence, Rhode Island, where we would do sitting meditation together, and we together crafted a undergraduate thesis that would help me sort of align my interests in Buddhism and psychology, but escape the drudgery of the curriculum at large. So I basically did independent field work right out of the gates in college. And it eventually, 2 years in or 3 years in my junior year abroad, I was in India as part of my field research for this independent study. And there I was at 20 years old in the Burmese Vihar, which, if you're not familiar, the Burmese Vihar in Bodh Gaya, India, was in its heyday the place where anyone who now is a first generation meditation pioneer in the West had spent time, including Ram Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldstein, Christopher Titmus, you name it, they had all made their way through the Burmese Vihar in Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha gained enlightenment. And at the time, I didn't really recognize the significance, but I was definitely following Joseph Campbell kind of inner voice about, keep following the breadcrumb trail, even though you don't exactly know where it's leading. I remember before heading out to Bodh Gaya, my family and I, you know, took the old family atlas, and this was before the time of internet and Google Maps, and we took an old dusty atlas out, we set it on the dining room table and tried to find Bodh Gaya and couldn't fucking find it, you know?
Right.
So I was definitely heading into the unknown, but something was calling me. You know, all the college pamphlet on the college abroad program said was, you know, meditate with the monks at 5 a.m. where the Buddha gained enlightenment. And so I went, and it was so powerful and so profound, because there I think I really found a footing in a culture that saw the world in a completely different way, and there I found a lot of the answers to the questions that I had been pining and mining over for several years leading up to that point. And it was by no means easy or pleasant, as you're very well familiar with in your writings about, you know, it's not about delight and it's not about feeling good. It's really about discovering something real. And I contracted dysentery several times. I was living in subpar conditions. But I was amongst people who were searching for truth and finding teachers and ways of dealing with life that actually finally registered and resonated for me. So that takes us to 20 years old. I don't know if you have any follow-up to that, and maybe some part of your story really resonates with that part thus far.
Yeah, actually, I have 2 points, and then I want to carry on because this is exceptionally fascinating to me. I always love hearing people's stories, especially when you have these wonderful journeys, and I appreciate your take on Joseph Campbell and following that. But so, I mean, I've resonated with so much of what you said, but 2 points I wanted to quickly unpack before we jump in. Well, 1 point, 1 question, I guess, is I really appreciate how you were saying earlier that you had gained, as far as material success, you know, as much as you could have asked for, so to speak, yet you still had this sense of dissatisfaction within your human experience. And I think that's really important, because a lot of times in conversations I've had with people, they don't understand how people that have that material success can experience suffering or dissatisfaction. You know, they liken that to more of the someone from my world, let's say, maybe that's hit a rock bottom with addiction, or, you know, just was abused or raped, or is living in a third world country with no roof over their head and starving to death. And of course that is all part of it. But you look at people like Robin Williams or Philip Seymour Hoffman, or musician wise like Chris Cornell. And I mean, this list goes on and on of people who could have or couldn't have probably asked for anything more material wise, but that is in no way a reflection of what's going on in their, just like you said, their inner world and the dissatisfaction that they are experiencing. And you know, these were people that some of them were married and with children, and the family life looked like it was well from the outside. But until you walk in that person's shoes, you really don't know what's going on. So I appreciate you mentioning that, because I think that's something that is so often overlooked. And you know, somebody listening right now might think, well, no, duh, that makes obvious sense. And I'm glad. But unfortunately, there are still so many people in this world that don't understand that suffering is suffering, period. I don't care who you are, where you come from. Pain is pain. Suffering is suffering. So that was 1 point I wanted to make before I have a question. I didn't know if there's anything you wanted to add on to that.
I mean, I guess I would just temper that. I believe that suffering is suffering, but I think there are relative different degrees of suffering. The main thing that I want to say is that I was particularly privileged and fortunate, and there are a lot of people that don't have even the material benefits. I'm not of the mind that, I mean, I think we require a certain standard of living or quality of life based on material world, that I think that's part of our shared humanity. You know, there are certain requirements, and short of that, I think that there is inevitable suffering that comes with that, and I think we shouldn't sort of bypass the realities of living a materialistically comfortable. But I guess then added to that is the fact that we also are psychological or spiritual beings, and I think it is one of the threads in the book, which is, you know, we are largely a materialistically oriented society where the standard of quality of life is based on what we have. And there we are absent a tradition of inner contemplation that reminds us that we are more than matter. And so we are bereft of understanding how to work with our feelings and seeing us in a much more multi-life perspective. So in that way, we're impoverished. You know, we are psychologically impoverished. And so I think, I mean, we can't underestimate the hardship of people who are both psychologically impoverished and materially impoverished. I think that would be the worst case scenario. On the other hand, I have been around people who are materially impoverished but have a spiritual inclination, and they tend to do a little bit better than the people that I at least work with in psychotherapy, for example, who are materially well off but emotionally and psychologically impoverished. So I think those complexities, they're very interesting, but I think it's worth noting there's an intersection of complexities there.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great point. And the area I was addressing, and I should have been more clear, certainly would have been the psychological that you were just speaking of. I speak from my own experience and many others that I know that, see, for me, I was always and still am middle to lower class. And so I've never gone without, but I've always my entire life lived paycheck to paycheck. And I'm grateful for every single thing I have. But when I look back at experiences of complete and utter depression where I felt I literally could not pull myself out, or terrible panic attacks, or the work I do now, particularly at a mental health and well-being facility with young adults ages 13 to 20, where they come from privileged backgrounds, the majority of them. This is a private care facility, but you know, the cuts on their arms or the suicide attempts are just as real, regardless of the money that they have surrounding them. So you're so right, and it is important to know that there are varying degrees on both sides. And of course, it is certainly much easier to start contemplating, you know, the divine interconnected relationship of all things in this manifest, you know, world that we're experiencing when we're not starving. You know,
exactly.
So yeah. I know to a certain extent that it is privileged in a way to even talk about that. But very good point that you make. There are varying degrees. I think for me, it's just the experience of depression that I've both personally been through and others I know. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. I don't care who it is. You know, just being locked in that place of despair is horrible, where literally you want to die. You know, you actually really want to die, and I know so many people that have taken their lives, and I've tried myself, and so I get
I actually think that it's not all that uncommon. I've had my own suicidal thoughts, and they've been in my family, so I mean I think probably there's a stigma around talking about it openly, but I think if you dig down, if you know, as a human being, I don't think that it's all that uncommon or rare to have these kinds of thoughts and experiences. But I think the bigger question is the bewilderment to which you respond to my story about how, you know, some people find it so uncanny that someone can achieve or be bequeathed a material success, but still have despair or existential angst. I think is part and parcel the lie of our modernity and of our culture's implicit agenda. It fails to it sort of fails to to remind people of the realities that if you get on the treadmill of success, that along the way, and certainly if you finally achieve it, you may be disappointed. You know, yeah. they don't tell you that when you're climbing the ladder or getting your degree or whatever. You know, certainly the marketing pitch or position of our culture wants to obfuscate that reality from us. But I think, you know, I don't think that internal response to a world that has become so consumeristic is all that unique. I think as shared human beings, we know that something is off. We know that achieving and fame and achieving material success and wealth, we are discovering that that's not all there is to life. In fact, those things can actually be a bigger pain in the ass. You know, I think if you talk to celebrities and they're very candid, being popular has paid a toll on their privacy, and having a lot of money means that you get paranoid about who's doing, you know, why the relationships that you have are there. You know, there is these hidden price tags to all the pursuits that we have as a materialistic society that no one wants to really talk about.
Oh, agreed. Well, and so, you know, something you mentioned, the other point that I wanted to ask you to unpack a little bit, and I think it flows perfectly with what we're addressing, is you were saying when you were in that school, and I believe you said it was Taoist, I might have misheard you, but or Zen, a teacher wrote on the board, "All suffering comes from I, me, and mine." And that's a very potent statement, and you know, one that here we are having a conversation. We have our, you know, our experience in non-dual teachings, regardless of the great wisdom tradition they may come from. But let's say someone's listening to this conversation and they hear that, and they don't really have the context to surround it, which is often the case. Can you? And this is big, but can you unpack that in whatever way you think would make it accessible for someone who's not all that familiar? And I know that's an entire show.
I'm laughing because we might need a month long retreat to unpack it.
I haven't had an
epiphany moment where I can say from the point of view of my gut where I live, that I've really understood it. But I mean, I think first and foremost, as a very impressionable, spiritually inclined seeker of 18 years old, to walk and see something that profound or provocative across a blackboard in white chalk made an impression. And you know, so you know, years later, looking back on the statement, of course, it really has to do with the fact that the whole entire orientation of our life is hinged upon a lie, a belief in our sense of self being a kind of fixed or autonomous or separate entity, if you will, even if you just want to go Newtonian, and like there's some building block or atom that makes us who we are that's unrelated or autonomous or separate. That's the great lie from which all our afflictions and disturbing emotions and reactions happen. And so they, you know, in many spiritual traditions, they call it the mula klesha, the root affliction. And as we know from the sort of point of view of metaphor, that you know, if you just grab a weed from the top, it will grow back. If you leave the root in place, you know. So if you don't go deep or penetrative enough in your spiritual analysis of what it is that's disturbing you and what it is that's causing pain, right? Because that is the great unifier of all living beings, is that nobody wants to have any pain. Okay, and so the misguided amongst us think that if we just gather up acorns and we have enough acorns, that somehow that pain will go away. But that's why you find that even celebrities commit suicide. So that proves itself to be not far reaching enough. But then can you blame them, because they're actually part of a culture where there is no really deep, profound methodology for analysis to look any deeper than the immediate circumstance. So that's the great misfortune of our culture, is that we're bereft of teachings and traditions that help orient us not outward, but towards the Mula Klesho, towards the places in our psyche where the deepest lingering axis mundi around which our suffering is stirred. So that, you know, that took a while to figure out. And I, like I said, you can get these concepts. I feel like after 20 years of studying them, I can share with them. I can discuss them. I can understand them, but you know, I still live from a point of view of being alienated and have my own share of greed and aversion and affliction. So I obviously haven't pulled out the weed at its deepest root, but at least I'm not confused about how I should spend my time.
Right. Yeah.
I know where to look, and it takes a lot of work to both expose and uncover the sensibility, this kind of distorted sensibility, and really work with its manifestation. So, but that's an orientation of life where it's much better spent. You see, I think. We can get into this, but I mean the alternative to a materialistic paradigm where you are outwardly focused on material gain versus a spiritual paradigm where you use your precious human life resources towards uprooting the fundamental psychological causes so that you could live much more expansively and harmoniously with your fellow beings and the planet at large, to me is the paradigm shift that I think is possibly emerging after 300 years of living very reductionistically and materialistically. I think consciousness is taking a front seat after 300 years or so of science and reductionism, and it's making its resurgence after we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater in the Age of Reason, let's say, in Western Europe, when there was a time where we began with religious authority and dogma and faith, blind faith, and then we had the emergence of, as a kind of pushback, we had the resurgence of reason, and with reason came science and technology and medicine and internet and sending people to the moon. But we in giving up blind faith, we also cut our ties with spirituality.
Yeah,
and so now we are the, you know, seventh generation or so of or more of people who are marooned, essentially spiritually marooned in a concrete world where we're on a treadmill.
Yeah.
So that's how I kind of see our predicament. We are growing. There is a growing sense that we missed something. Mm. And you can, I think when you teach, I'm sure you feel it. People are of, the crowds are bigger and bigger, and the people that are coming they're looking for something, and it's not on offer at Whole Foods or on Amazon.
Right.
And go ahead.
No, I was gonna say, well, that's for me, you know, and I didn't have any context around it at the time, but going back to like 13, 14 years old, that's what initially struck a chord right away. The first time I was introduced to punk rock and hardcore music was, it wasn't, you know, something for the masses. It was this raw, completely raw, energetic, just passionate music, screaming about anti-establishment. And, you know, whether it's right or wrong, that's kind of besides the point. For me, it was just something deeper. And that was my introduction into looking, you know, beyond just the material world, looking for something more. And it's funny now that here I am 40 years old, and if I go to a sangha or a satsang or teach, I'm meeting all of these people, could be in their 20s, 30s, 40s, but punk rock, hardcore, these things were their introduction, because that was a natural, or the spiritual path is a natural segue from them. You know, for many people, that's their foot in the door. It's almost like, you know, marijuana is the gateway drug. Well, for a lot of people, punk rock and hardcore was, or like you said, of course, suffering was. But what led people to be interested in this countercultural kind of lifestyle? Their dissatisfaction with what popular society has to offer. So, you know,
disillusionment.
Exactly, right. And then, though, that crosses over into a lot of what is presented as spirituality today, and we're going to get into this in a second. I laughed when I read McMindfulness because I've used that term in my own books, and that's something you talk about, and I very much relate. But, you know, as I was reading that, it reminds me of one of the most, well, the lineage for me that resonates most deeply is that of Advaita, and going back to Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta Maharaj and then Ramesh Balsekar. And it's essentially just non-dual teachings. So it's found in any of the great wisdom traditions. They all just have their own language around it. But Ramesh talks quite a bit about, and this also is quite controversial, but he says no one has ever been enlightened. Nobody, not a single person, has ever been enlightened. And the reason he says that, though, which I absolutely love, is because who is there to be enlightened? Right. Which circles back to that, you know, comment, all suffering comes from I, me, and mine. There literally is no separate self to be enlightenment. Enlightenment is all there is. It's just that we have these identities that are placed on them, and not that that's wrong, because it's what we were born with and what was instilled in us. But he goes on to talk about how, you know, this is not the sort of thing that is popular and sells. And you would look, he would give talks at his apartment in Bombay, India, and he's since passed, but he would have maybe 30 people there. And here's a person that had 10 books out translated in numerous different languages. You know, so on that end of things, his message was reaching a wide audience, but it's not what people want to hear. You know, they want to hear, this is how you do it. Here's five simple steps and you're going to be great. But it's all about you. It's just essentially putting a band-aid on this body mind organism. And the thing that he would say, and Nisargadatta would say, is that at the end of the day, there's really nothing you can do to become enlightened. It happens when it happens. And so, you know, yes, there is comfort in doing these practices. And of course, you know, I do them and I read these books all the time because they bring me comfort and they remind me to come back. They make life easier to navigate as this body mind organism. But anyway, so all that to say, to kind of come back to McMindfulness, that's something I have written about and does trouble me, is that a lot of what is presented as quote-unquote spirituality today has been quite watered down, and in some extreme cases, which I've talked about on the show before, has led to people not seeking out proper help, but doing these kind of band-aid practices, and there have been cases of people who have taken their own lives because they thought and were promised, you know, this is going to fix you, when they needed much more care and psychiatric attention to what was happening. So anyways, McMindfulness, you talk about it. I would love to hear your thoughts on anything I just said, or just McMindfulness in general, because it's something definitely that, again, I appreciate you discuss.
Well, maybe we can thread it back in with the narrative of my story, not to make it about me, but I think I provide some context by which how I came up with the term and coined the term McMindfulness. Because so we left off with India, right? So I'm in India, 20 years old. Yep. I meet a teacher. I feel like my soul comes back to itself and finds a paradigm and point of view and reference and orientation, if you will, for life that makes sense and resonates. And I'm still involved in this undergraduate dissertation where I'm basically doing field research to understand Buddhism. But as soon as I leave India, I head to Harvard Medical School, to the Mind-Body Institute run by Dr. Herbert Benson, who was the author of The Relaxation Response and probably responsible for the first wave of really credible gold standard scientific research on meditation. So that contrast of coming out of 6 months of India with the monks in a monastery, very simple life, even getting sick and being away from home and lonely, but yet still feeling like my soul had found its place again and found its operating system, a reboot on its operating system. I came back to Boston and to the medical center where they were basically running clinical trials on using meditation, but I found what secular and scientific meditation looked like. which looked very different. You had people in need of meditation, but that weren't interested in the culture aspects. Okay.
Yeah.
And they weren't interested in Buddhism, and they weren't interested in the Buddha and what the Buddha had to say about suffering and the psychology and the Four Noble Truths and the, you know, more than just the simple breath work. Let's say that's the entry level, most reduced point of reference about relaxing was all that people were getting, and really, frankly, all they may have needed for their predicament. Mm-hmm. And so I have to kind of reconcile these two experiences. On the one hand, what I felt to be the full picture of a different way of living, and on the other, a kind of reduction that was accessible to people given where they were. Mm. And, you know, it just happens to be from a personality standpoint, I had been so deeply impacted by what I saw in India that part of me felt a little like people were getting robbed. I don't share that opinion now, because now I very much understand the, you know, the slogan that different strokes for different folks. You know, people need different things at different times in their life, and Buddhism is not for everybody, mm-hmm. by a long shot. And also Buddhism is not, you know, innocent of its shortcomings by any means. But sure. At the time, having such a profound, you know, because what I saw in India was an alternative paradigm to materialism, whereas what I saw at Harvard Medical School was an extraction of a meditation technique placed back into a materialistic world so that people could, you know, find it palpable and useful. And actually, you know, the research was clear, you know, people get better, you know, so can't argue with that. Right.
Right.
But from a young person's mind, trying to reconcile these two things, it followed me for several years until I started seeing, you know, from Benson, the wave of research then migrated towards Kabat-Zinn. And from Kabat-Zinn, we got the mindfulness revolution. And with the mindfulness revolution, we had thousands and thousands of research paper and documented clinical hours of benefits of meditation, and, you know, very well done published studies on a gamut of health indices that all were saying the same thing. But to me, they weren't addressing this fundamental paradigm problem. And so, and I also, you know, there was a 10-year period where every other book that was coming out in the spiritual world was something on mindfulness for this and mindfulness for that.
Right.
And also they weren't very, you know, and programs developed and these things weren't cheap. And so suddenly I just had a little bit of a skeptical stance. While on the one hand, many more millions of people were being exposed, on the other hand, what they were being exposed to me felt like it was shortchanging but the potential benefits that I had been exposed to. And so I just came about with this term, McMindfulness, to sort of push back on our culture and its appetite for the spectacular and its hungering for a panacea and its kind of colonialization where extraction happens almost spontaneously. We like things and we pull them off the shelf and pull them out of context and then sort of glorify them in some kind of sensationalized way. And I mean, that's, you know, that's how I sometimes view what has happened here, is like, we don't need the rest of it. Is there's a kind of an implicit hubris. And so, you know, part of my contention in the book Gradual Awakenings that I've recently wrote is really to say, okay, well, the mindfulness movement has opened the door for so many millions of people, and let's not forget the benefit that they're deriving from lowered cholesterol and blood pressure to relaxation and stress reduction to even preventing the incidence of depressive relapse, for example, in the clinical literature. So I, you know, there's no contending about that. But on the other hand, you know, our culture is still hell-bent on destroying the planet. So how do you reconcile those things? We have a spiritual technology, and the same is true with yoga. We have a spiritual technology that's been extracted. So we have the asanas, and we have mindfulness, the breathing and paying attention. But what we've left behind is the what we are now awakening to is called the contemplative science or the contemplative psychology, out of which those things have been extracted. Mm-hmm. And within those sciences and within those ancient psychologies, there you have the quantum, if you will, the quantum theories about self and about interconnectivity and about compassion and about how the mind works and about blindness and unconsciousness. You have all this very sophisticated, deep architecture and methodology mm-hmm. that could really address some of the root causes for the ills that we see both in society and the environment and geopolitics and the rest, and in the individual mind. And so McMindfulness for me was an attempt to raise in a kind of provocative way, in the way that I saw that blackboard statement.
Right.
It's a little provocative. It's like, oh, what's going on over there? I thought mindfulness was great. Well, what, when you say McMindfulness, suddenly it makes you wonder, like, what could possibly be wrong with it? And in a way, it's a little cheeky because it's not like it's something's wrong with it. It's not like a lie.
Right, right.
It's just opening the door to alert people to follow the breadcrumb trail a little closer so that they could come closer to the sciences that are there, not the religions. I'm not really all that interested in religions. Mm. I'm interested in the sciences, the Adhyatma Vidya, it's called in the Indian science, is about restoring a human being to sanity and to health by way of introspection. And meditative technologies extracted from those sciences are in a way limited in what they can offer. And that doesn't mean that the health benefits that millions of people across the world are benefiting from is not neutralized. It's just now I'm contending that we are in a position after 30 years of promoting mindfulness that probably there is a growing interest in people that have now been practicing this for some time mm-hmm. where they could maybe take it a little further. And what are they going to find? They're going to start to find that there are deep sciences there. And I think those deep sciences, I think those hold a lot of promise.
I couldn't agree more. And I'm so glad you mentioned that. That's what I love about listening to the Dalai Lama speak, for example. He is a big proponent of science, and he said something to the effect of, if science proves some element of Buddhism or Buddhism as a whole wrong, then we need to change with science. And I've always loved that about him. Or even Ramesh Balsekar, who I mentioned before, always wrote about the comparison between what the sages of India had been teaching as far back as the Vedas and what our modern science is now saying, and how they correlate so closely. They're just, again, different languages, but saying very, very similar things. And I'm glad that you use that in your work. I think that is so important. And I always get excited when I hear people on the show talking about that. As far back for me, my first introduction was What the Bleep Do We Know? And I'm friends with the filmmaker, Betsy Chassie, and she's even admitted at the time they took liberties. They made stretches. Some of it was a bit of a reach. However, that was a great, great film that really sparked the interest and conversation in that regard. Not to say it hadn't been happening already, but it certainly, I think, brought a lot of people's attention and interest into these fields and where they intersect. And that's, I don't know, it's a kind of, for me, very exciting time to be alive and watch these two start to, in many regards, work more closely together rather than fight one another. But we are very similar as far as the not to, what's the word I'm looking for? I'll just say not to talk shit about religion, but for me personally, my interests don't necessarily lie there as much either. But coming back to your book, Miles, it's based essentially, or a backdrop of it is with the Lam Rim, something that's a very, very deep text, but I appreciate the way that you bring it out and make it quite accessible in your writing. So can you talk a bit about what the Lam Rim is for those that aren't familiar? Again, I know a very big question, but is there a way to nutshell that into this conversation?
Sure, I'd love to. I mean, Lam Rim means gradual stages of the path, okay? And Lam Rim comes out of around the 10th century in Tibet, where Buddhism and various strands and teachings of Buddhism had already been around for centuries. And so if you can imagine in our own contemporary context in the West, you might, you know, especially New York City, for example, you could go down one block and there would be an Advaita center, and another block there would be a Zen center, another block they're talking about self-care, and another block, another center they're practicing compassion, somewhere else they're doing prayer. So you start to get a sense of bewilderment that how do all these disparate seeming traditions and teachings operate? You know, what's the grand unifying theory, if you will, because I know you're a big fan of Wilbur. So what the Lam Rim does is it was an attempt in the 10th century in Tibet. The Tibetans were having some, what would they call, contradictions in the teachings. They were a little miffed by how do these things work together? There's these things called renunciation, where we're really trying to work with our addictions. And then there are these techniques for compassion. And then, of course, there are the high-level techniques of Tantra that, actually don't say don't stop. They just say transform your addictions and afflictions, because they're really riding on potent energies. And so they called on one of the great masters in India, and he, Lama Atisha, and Atisha came, and the story goes, he gathers up all of Buddha's teachings, but puts them into a kind of chronological order that reconciles some of these curiosities and confusions. And so the Lam Rim then becomes kind of like a guidebook. Mm-hmm. Or a roadmap. If you want to go from LA to New York or New York to LA, you want to take the clearest path possible, and you want to have a guide in your hand so that you can traverse the terrain without getting sidetracked or lost, right? And so if you want to navigate the spiritual landscape, you're going to have to confront certain addictions first before you open up into a new vista where there maybe other challenges. And so when you get to those other challenges, maybe you need different tools. Mm-hmm. So the Lam Rim organizes the psychological development of an individual along three main horizons. The first is taking care of your own mind and your own afflictions, and making sure that you have some facility and confidence in interrupting your own afflictive responses and clarifying your own distortions. So taking care of your own mind first. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't just end there, like you arrive at a milestone where you can smoke a cigar and say, I've made it. Because from that milestone, then you look down and you start to see, well, I have some confidence that I can work with on my own mind, which believe me is not some small claim. That is a huge, huge leap from where we are in materialism, where the only climbing we're doing is the corporate ladder, for example.
Yes.
So, I mean, think about your soul is migrating through infinite life and infinite time, and it is finally discovered that buying more stuff and consuming more shit or being a robot to some corporate structure is completely disenfranchising to your innate capacity. And you set your sights and motivate yourself to actually work with your internal world, and you achieve some level of confidence that you can separate out the nasty bits and really cultivate the wonderful bits. And then you realize that's not the end of the game. You live with others, and others are really still afflicted, and they're really not having a good time. And you can't escape them and sit in and eat grapes in Greece while everybody else is really still tormented. So you have arrived at a milestone only to like take off your backpack and all the tools in it and take on another one for another leg of the journey. And so there you have compassion practices, there you have resilience training, there you have a deeper psychology about the nature of interpersonal dynamics, and you learn to be a firefighter for humanity. And going, you know, like you and me, if we, I don't know about you, maybe I don't speak for you, but I'm not one to run into a burning building. You know, to me, that scares the shit out of me.
Sure.
However, there are human beings that have been trained that don't blink an eye when there's a burning building.
Right.
And so they're going in there. Why are they going in there? Well, they've been trained to override their afflictive instincts from evolution and actually motivated to take care of other people who are trapped there. And so that is a new horizon ideal. That's called the Bodhisattva mission, the altruistic mission.
Right.
So once you've achieved your slumber stage of what's called renunciation, I call it evolutionary self-care, because it basically suggests that you're an infinite being, and you could be distracted and misguided to chase fame and profit and all the rest of it, but then you really come to understand that that's not the end game. The end game is taking care of your mind. Mm-hmm. And then you become a firefighter for other living beings. So that would be the middle stages. And then finally you work towards the Mula Klesha, which is the final leg of the journey, is going as deeply as you can to uproot the core affliction of I, me, mine, and sense of separateness. So this is what I try to describe in my book. It is essentially a roadmap in which the Buddha's teachings were organized and arranged in such a way that you can make your way through the first phase of taking care of yourself and into the next phase of taking care of others, and finally into the third phase of really understanding the deep nature of reality, so that you can be far more creative and competent in being a kind of a leader, you know, or a hero, you know, or heroine.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so Miles, as I'm listening to you talk and I was reading your book, I had to laugh to myself as I think, where were you like 15, 16, 17 years ago as I stumbled my way into Middletown, Connecticut? And I forgot the name of the center. It's still there. I should know this. But it is a wonderful Tibetan center. The teacher there actually was the abbot of the Dalai Lama's monastery in Dharamsala, and then the one in Ithaca, New York, and then retired to Middletown. And I remember, you know, I went in there because I was very new and interested in Buddhism and meditation, and I got the three volumes of the Great Treatise on the Stages of the Path to Enlightenment, and I did not know what the fuck was going on. You know, there I am, like these three thick, heady texts, and I showed up. You know, every Tuesday were teachings, every Sunday, and I was there for a few months until I was finally just like, I don't get it. I am in over my head. Similar to when I first started reading Ken Wilber. You know, I'm like, what is going on here? But now, many, many, many years later, I can look back and start to make some semblance of sense in it. But that's the beauty in what you're doing and in this book, you know, Gradual Awakening, is that you're presenting these otherwise very difficult concepts for at least someone like me to comprehend when I'm reading these very certainly brilliant works of ancient teachers, but they're just not transmitted in a way that, again, for me in those early stages, were easy to comprehend. And who knows, I still have those books, and I have not I think I have some kind of traumatic association
aversion
with them.
Yeah,
exactly. They're still on my bookshelf, but I've never tried to go back and read them. But maybe after reading your work, I'm going to I'll have to crack them open and see if they make any more sense. But I again my hat's off to you, because that is not easy stuff to take and then make or present in an accessible way, which you do. So I really love that's what you're doing in your work, or at least part of what you're doing in your work in your book.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. You know, I mean, I have two responses to that.
Yeah,
I mean, it is called Gradual Awakening. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I, you know, it's no small thing. I don't know how long you've been doing this work, but I do think it's important that I alert to my students, for example, that there's no quick fix here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think there's been a lot of spiritual teachings that have been co-opted by marketing machines that pitch and sell to people some deliverance. And that's no more true than any other place than here in the United States, I think. There is a kind of inclination, both from the popular culture that want our hunger, and then there is a all too easy pitch that if you do this in 6 weeks, you'll be fine and you'll lose weight or you'll be happier. Happiness, 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 but instantaneous happiness, right? And so I have been around the block now over 20 years doing this stuff, and I have had, you know, one of the hardest years of my life just this year.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's important, and one of my motivations is to alert people that this is a lifelong commitment. You know, there are some spiritual teachings that talk about a flash of light and it brings you into the now and everything's going to be fine. I'm not an advocate of that kind of. I think it's misleading. I think for a few, select few, maybe a spontaneous flash of brilliance has happened, but for the rest of us, if we're sitting around going, "Where's my flash of light?" The alternative is nothing happens. Whereas this approach, the Lamrim, is get on a path. It doesn't have to be the Tibetan one, but get on a path and commit to it for your whole life. And if you don't arrive at the end where you're supposed to uproot the middle, the Mula Klesha, and be enlightened, at least you would have spent your precious human life doing something meaningful. And along the way, you would have understood more about yourself and others, and you would have become at least a little bit modicum more patient and a little wiser and a little more patient. And that doesn't mean at any step of the path you're not in pain. It just means that you're maturing and you're growing. It's no longer about the pleasure principle, it's about the purpose principle. Yes. You're having a more purposeful existence as a human being. You're becoming more of what you're meant to be. Yeah. So that's the first thing. And then the other thing about the language in this, I mean, I do have to hand it to my teachers, you know, Bob Thurman and Joe Luizzo. If you just look at my lineage, if you will, like Bob Thurman, Professor Robert Thurman was the first Westerner to be ordained a Tibetan Buddhist monk from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So you could say that he's the land bridge from Tibet to the West in terms of this transmission of this kind of curriculum, the Lamrim curriculum, if you will. But Bob, what Bob does is he did some very revolutionary things. You know, I would very much encourage people getting one of Bob's early books called The Jewel Tree of Tibet.
Yes.
And which is a Lamrim book, okay, and it's one that I devoured and read several times. And what he does is he uses language that far greater numbers of people in the West could really receive and appreciate. I mean, it's poetics. It's about jazz. It's about learning your scales and then being able to play. And Bob Thurman can really fucking play.
Yes, he can.
and he can entertain, and he can make it vibrant, and he can attract even the most skeptical to disarm and feel something, feel vital from these Lamrim teachings. And so I think that is the first land bridge away from the kind of hardcore Tibetan to a more modern Western sensibility, but not doing what happened with the meditation with Herbert Benson. It's not a reduction. It's a language game. That's what we're talking about. Bob didn't tinker with the tradition. He preserved the tradition. I see him as a preserver.
Yeah.
But he played with the language so that it became more poetic and accessible. And then Bob trained my teacher, Joe Luizzo, who ended up being a psychiatrist and medical doctor, who made another step forward in the evolution, I think, and took Bob's liberties. I mean, he's well-trained. He is through and through a Buddhist scholar. He is a Sanskrit Tibetologist trained at Columbia. There's no question he's put his time in, and there's no question that his he's done his work in terms of scholastic studies, but then he did another language game himself where he medicalized and psychologicalized and nuanced with neuroscience the Lamrim. So I am, you know, I met these cats when I was 20, so I'm like born and raised suckling at the teat of this kind of artistic liberty. People that are well steeped in Buddhist literature and yet have the faculty to present these things in a way that tantalizes and awakens and is playful and creative and accessible. And so, I mean, my book, Gradual Awakening, I think is, you know, my humble offering to continue that line of, I've spent 20 years now with the Tibetans. I love them deeply. I bow my head to their tradition and their culture. I will, to my last breath, do everything I can to alleviate the suffering of that community who have bared witness and experienced one of the greatest Holocausts of the last century and have bequeathed to humanity very openly and charitably some of the most profound wisdom traditions that have ever existed on this planet. However, I also struggled for a very long time, as you did, with understanding those very long texts in an archaic language, through a translator, no less. I mean, I clocked my hours trying to study with some of these Tibetans through translation, and I racked my brain. And you know what? I wouldn't do it any other different. I mean, I think, you know, people nowadays who get a quick translation, direct transmission are really fortunate. But for me, I needed to put in the time to really understand and appreciate the things that I have come to learn. Mm. That being said, I really, you know, I hope that people do get a taste for the Lam Rim that in a way that makes sense to them. And if, I mean, when you put work out, there'll definitely be, you know, people that are not so pleased. You know, maybe the Orthodox religious community won't like some of my word choices or the ways that I present things. And on the other side, you know, it will still look too religious or whatever in terms of the secular audience who just want to keep with mindfulness. And you know, they'll look at the book, you know, the cover of my book is some mala beads, you know. So, you know, you'll get these people that are, you know, on either side of the spectrum, more entrenched in their own kind of worldview. And, you know, you just have to be who you are. And for me, I can say this is a true expression of my path and my commitment to humanity and what I felt called to share.
Well, Miles, I bow deeply to you. I thank you for your very authentic and humble message. It certainly shines through in everything you've shared. I absolutely love that Bob was a root teacher for you. He is definitely a friend of the show. I had a privilege, I was privileged to meet him and visit him back in 2010 in his office in Colombia, and to see, you know, just the very, very ancient text that he has. That was a real treat for me. And he had also just gotten a tattoo for his wife that he was very excited to show me, because I'm heavily tattooed. He's like, hey, check this out. So, you know, not only is he scholarly, he, like you said, he's entertaining. He connects with people. A great wisdom teacher. So we love Bob on the show and the Be Here Now Network. And, you know, don't take my word for it, anyone listening, that this is a great book. I'm looking at the list of endorsements you have, and I mean, from Bob to Richard Gere, no big deal, but Sharon Salzberg, a lot of friends of the show here, and Sharon has her show on the network. Elena Brower, I'll be speaking with her tomorrow for the show.
Damian, oh, tell Eccles. Elena I said hi. I mean, that's a very powerful woman. I mean, I look up to her. She's a great entrepreneur and a beautiful leader for everybody. And please give her my best regards.
I will. Yeah, I'm excited to have you guys back to back. It's really great. And then some others. Damian Eccles, another friend of the show. Noah Levine, of course. He wrote the foreword for my first book. Ethan Nickturn. He was, I think, the second guest I ever had on the show. And then your teacher, Joseph, and, you know, so people don't give praise if they don't mean it. So, again, don't take my word for it. This book is incredible. Miles, I think you went above and beyond in just your presence on the show and showing or sharing with our listeners just a peek of what is held within the pages of Gradual Awakening. An absolutely fantastic book. The one thing I didn't share, Miles, I forgot to ask you, wasn't in your bio, is your website. Where can people find out more about you and the work you're doing?
Yeah, it's just my name, www.milesneale.com, M-I-L-E-S, N for Nancy, E-A-L-E.com. It's currently, as of today, August 2nd, under development, so you can expect the brand new launch of my new book and the new website and the book tour and all the things that I'll be doing along the way, and probably within the week or by next week. So maybe by the time this show airs, you know, everything will be out. And I want to just, we have a few moments, yeah, just to thank you for having me. I know we have a nice story about trying to put this podcast on, and the teaching out of it, Chris, is really like timing is everything. Yeah. And we are, I mean, I am, it just showed my own impatience as a human being and my lack of trust that, but the stars did align eventually. And I'm very, very blessed and fortunate to have time with you and to hear about you and to share these stories. And, you know, if there weren't any time, I know we could kick back and this conversation could just continue.
Absolutely.
I also want to just shout out to Alice Peck, who both, you know, put us together and worked on both of our books and is a huge inspiration to me and a wordsmith par excellence. And without her help, literally Gradual Awakening, because of my shortness and confidence, my my own ability to write and my own, you know, my own lack of confidence in delivering this. If she didn't push me and she didn't take an older draft, which was just going to be an ebook, and send it to the publisher, it would have never manifested. So, you know, thank you, Alice, and thank you to all the angels out there who make everything happen for every single being, every single day, all the, you know, the people we don't have time to name. I mean, life is a beautiful miracle and a testament to how interconnected we are. And there's no, I know you share this with me, Chris, that any success that we have is really owed and a testament to all the living beings that make, you know, offer their precious life force to make these things happen. Yeah. And I do hope that along the way in the book tour that people do benefit from this book and that it really brings humanity closer and puts me into direct contact with new people whom can inspire me and help me grow. And I hope I can return the favor. And I hope you and I, this is that we'll have many more conversations and our paths will intersect many more times. Thank you so much for all your work.
Miles, thank you. What a beautiful sentiment to end on. I know it's a case of not if, but when our paths cross in person. I very much look forward to meeting you. Thank you for those kind words about Alice, because yes, what an inspiration. Two of my books would not have come to fruition without her as well. So much love to dear Alice Peck. Please check her work out. And I'll just say to end this up, if you're listening to this on the Be Here Now Network, scroll down and you will see the link to Miles' website. So either you can type it in, but if you want to just scroll down, the link will be right there. We will also have Miles' book linked, so you can find it. It'll be available everywhere. It's with Sounds True, a tremendous publisher who did my second book. So you'll be able to find it anywhere books are sold. The release date is September 18th, if I remember correctly. Is that...
That's right. Yep.
Perfect.
Yep. So, and we launch at Tibet House on the Wednesday, the 12th of September, and that will be live stream. So you can join us from anywhere. And we're going to have a ritual, not just a book talk, but a ritual to launch the book. And there's a whole bonus chapter that's available on my website. Once you purchase the book, you're free to access an entire new chapter that Sounds True was so gracious in offering me. So that will be on the website on the book page. So thank you very much.
All right, Miles. Well, thank you. The book again, Gradual Awakening, The Tibetan Buddhist Path of Becoming Fully Human. I can't recommend it enough. And until next time, this is Chris Grosso with the Indie Spirituals Podcast on the Be Here Now Network.